2003 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents Session 326, Thou Mayest Choose for Thyself, an LDS reflection on evil, bad acts, and self-destructive behavior. A paper presented by Ken Driggs, with a response by Bill Hansen.
None of these privileges would have been ours had Adam and Eve remained in the garden. This emphatic rejection of original sin sets LDS doctrine apart from traditional Christian teachings. Mormon philosopher and educator Sterling McMurrin has written that the central dogma of traditional Christian orthodoxy is the doctrine of original sin. From it follows the doctrine of salvation by the grace of God only. He describes original sin for traditional Christians as a consequence of the sin of the first man. Human nature in its very being is sinful, and every man from the moment of his creation, therefore, is by nature sinful and is set against God, impotent to merit salvation and worthy only of an eternal damnation and punishment. At another point, McMurrin opined that original sin is probably the worst idea that the mind of man ever concocted, and that it's just a nonsense. It's not just a nonsense, but evil nonsense, the idea that human nature is fundamentally corrupt from its origins. I see original sin and its belief that man is devilish and a carnal animal who, if left to his own devices, will not do good as a doctrine that undercuts individual responsibility. It sets up excuses for not striving to do better. In spite of all of the dreadful conduct in human history, I do not see men and women as evil by nature, flawed and frail, but not evil. Mormonism is also a very practical religion that offers personal rewards in this mortal life. I often close my Gospel Principles class, which I teach in the Atlanta ward, by bearing my testimony that if you strive to adopt these things, the Lord does not promise you a life free of conflict and trials, but you will experience better relationships with family and friends, more satisfying experiences at work, and you'll have more harmony in your days. The founding principle is that men and women are not born evil. A companion and consistent doctrine is the rejection of infant baptism. LDS children are baptized at age 8 as opposed to infants because this is seen as the age of accountability, a point when they begin to be responsible for their own actions. Joseph Smith taught that power is not given unto Satan to tempt little children. Baptism should only come when people have arrived at the years of accountability. The underlying belief is that knowledge is required in order for there to be sin. The sinner has to know he or she is doing wrong. We are taught that children not yet 8 years of age cannot know right from wrong. I believe that this principle is not limited to children, but to all men and women who can only be measured by their individual personal knowledge of right from wrong and their ability to make meaningful choices. Also, there is a great emphasis on traditional family in Mormon culture. The LDS Church places great emphasis on the traditional family. Mom and dad together, dad wise and involved, mom at home full-time if possible, caring love and gospel-centered living permeating the home. The underlying principle seems to be that there is no more important place for children to be taught right from wrong than in the home by their parents. So what of the child whose parents do not or the child whose parents do not or cannot teach these lessons? Or worse, those children whose parents teach them bad conduct, who teach them to do evil. I think in thinking through this, as I was organizing this article, I conceptualized three different ways that I think Mormons would define evil, and that there's overlap in all three of these, so don't see them as exclusive as I read through them. First, there is a sin which violates God's commandments. These are transgressions which we may not understand beyond the fact that God, through his scriptures and his prophets, has commanded it. Sometimes we do not know the reason for a particular commandment. However, we show our faith and trust in God when we obey him without knowing why. Second, there are the knowing acts and omissions which bring harm to other people. We hurt them physically. We hurt them by denying them the fruits of their labors. We injure their good name and reputation. We wound others emotionally and psychologically. I count racism and rampant personal greed that is so much a part of the American economic system as a kind of a sin, even though we often passively absorb them from the societies around us. I also include as sin when we fail to do something within our power that would help others, because I see the gospel as carrying an obligation to not only avoid bad acts, but also an affirmative obligation to do good. Finally, we do things or refuse to do things which affect our eternal progression. We are taught that we were not created but existed before this lifetime. In the premortal life, we were free agents. That means we had power to act for ourselves. Also, that we continue to exist afterwards. We know that we came to this earth in order to gain a mortal body, which is expected for our eternal progression, and we chose to do so. We know that we had to learn to deal with evil and temptation in the state beyond the veil because we are outside of the immediate presence of God. Brigham Young pretty much covered what I would discuss with this definition when he said that sins consist in doing wrong when we know we can do better. I find it interesting that Brother Brigham also made a distinction between acts which amounted to a direct opposition of God and his government and transgressing a command of God. Each of us is unique, and God knows our individual characteristics. What may interfere with the progression of one may not affect another. We all have special talents and abilities given to us by our Heavenly Father. When we are born, we brought these talents and abilities with us. Sometimes the Lord gives us weakness, so we will work hard to overcome them. Two distinctly Mormon statements of conduct come to mind for this third definition of sin, the definition that involves interfering with our eternal progression. And that's the word of wisdom found in section 89 of the Doctrine and Covenants and the 9th and 13th articles of faith. The word of wisdom counsels us against the use of alcohol, caffeinated drinks, and tobacco. Presumably, drug abuse would also fall under these prohibitions of the word of wisdom without its being mentioned by name. For many people, alcohol and drug abuse is closely associated with acts of violence and self-destruction, which harm others and work against their eternal progression. Tobacco mostly associates with health problems, with injury to the body and disease, which shorten our years in this mortal life. Health problems can be expensive to us as individuals and as a society and can rob us of our ability to do things in life. Does this have any implications for our immortality, for our state on the other side of the veil? Perhaps, but it strikes me as having a lot more to do with living a fuller, less troubled life as mortal beings. By eliminating possible serious health problems, we're more able to focus on the spiritual lessons to be learned while on this earth. And consider that the word of wisdom describes itself as the order and will of God in temporal salvation of all saints in the last days. The ninth article of faith, in the ninth article of faith, the prophet Joseph said, "We believe that all God has revealed, all that he does now reveal, and we believe that he will yet reveal many great and important things pertaining to the kingdom of God." In the 13th article of faith, the prophet said, "We believe in being honest, true, chaste, benevolent, virtuous, and in doing good to all men. Indeed, we may say that we follow the admonition of Paul. We believe all things, we hope all things, and we have endured many things, and hope to be able to endure all things. If there is anything virtuous, lovely, or of good report, or praiseworthy, we seek after these things." I understand these both to be aspirations and commandments, which counsel Mormons on ways to realize a richer, fuller life on both spiritual and temporal levels. For me, science, the exploration of human beings, our world, and the vastness of the universe is not only a temporal, but a spiritual reaching out. The 9th and 13th articles of faith are part of the basis for my own belief that the gospel as Mormons understand it requires us to strive to understand this mortal world, to learn as much as we can about who we are and how we function. I would include in the things that are knowable and the things that shape and influence, those things that shape and influence her human personality and conduct. These comments reflect the confidence of Mormon faith, a belief that ultimately scientific inquiry will support LDS cosmology, not challenge it. Such an attitude encourages believers to become scientists, not to fear science. At this point, I want to switch over, and that's basically my understanding of LDS doctrine. And now I want to talk a little bit about what I've observed with my clients as a criminal lawyer. And that is that we're not all born equals in life. I had a highly publicized Georgia client in the last few years who, after more than a decade and a half of being tormented by an especially evil mental illness psychiatrists have classified as schizoaffective disorder, shot to death two innocent strangers in a Walmart parking lot. In his confession to police that day, he said he sought to commit suicide by being executed in the state electric chair. He came to this point in spite of a very close, loving, deeply religious family that did everything they could to address his illness. In high school and college, he'd been a football hero of considerable ability, but all the while that illness was growing at his center until it completely destroyed his ability to lead anything remotely resembling a normal life. Preceding the fatal shootings were a dozen attempts at suicide, much strange behavior, many psychiatric hospitalizations, and a growing morbid desire to die. I recall my first meeting with him distinctly. He was in a local jail after his arrest for the two murders. He was so deep in depression that he could not clean himself, lift his head to look me in the eye, or construct a paragraph of speech. I've never seen a human being in so much agony. This great, dark presence of despair filled the room. After months in a state hospital, he was declared competent to stand trial, but was far from cured of his illness. In the court, he still wanted to die in the electric chair, but at other times he expressed a desire to live if he could get treatment. In the end, he insisted on pleading guilty and demanded that the jury sentence him to death. He threatened them in dramatic testimony if they did not do so. 12 citizens of the small community that once cheered him on the football field agreed and sentenced him to death. Finally, while the judicial process moved forward, he hung himself with a bedsheet on death row in Jackson, Georgia. His funeral was held in a small African-American Baptist church where his family had been respected members for generations. You never get past these cases, I'm telling you. They still choke me up. During the two-hour service, those who knew him as a friend, as a relative, and as a local football hero spoke movingly of their experiences with him. I spoke briefly but sobbed through my remarks. None had any doubt that their friend was in heaven with Jesus, finally relieved of his pain. The only evil recognized there was that of mental illness that had come to possess him. I certainly felt that way. The funeral was one of the most moving and validating days of my life. It was difficult to express the emotions I felt when, at the urging of the pastor, the congregation stood and applauded myself and the other lawyers who had represented him. Obviously, now that's an extreme case. I want to now describe sort of my general caseload, the non-capital caseload, particularly in the DeKalb County Public Defender's Office. DeKalb County is part of metropolitan Atlanta. It's about 850,000 people. Statistically, the county is about 56% black, about 35% white, and the rest other. My caseload is probably 98% black, overwhelmingly male, and overwhelmingly young. Obviously, poverty is the norm for public defender clients. It is rare that I will represent someone who graduated from high school or even has his GED. The majority do not have permanent residences. In Atlanta, thousands of people live in hotels, renting by the day or the week, or in small informal boarding houses. Many bounce from one relative or acquaintance to another until they wear out their welcome. A substantial number simply live on the streets. Very few have extended work histories, and even those that do generally are laborers with few skills. The type of employer I most often hear reported to me is a labor pool. The public defender's office has a used clothing closet, which I have to draw from for nearly all of my clients' trials. The great majority are in their late teens or 20s. One particular thing I noticed among a good many of my clients is very limited verbal skills. They have such limited means of expression that they have a difficult time relating to me information about their crime and their lives. They cannot explain themselves to judges and apparently lack the skills to mediate personal conflicts. They often get very frustrated by their inability to be understood. I believe that this limited power of self-expression is directly related to violent interpersonal conflict. It's obvious to me that many of my clients are poor because of mental illness, mental retardation, drug and alcohol addiction, and sociopathic behavior. These handicaps are often multi-generational. It does not mean that all poor people are impoverished because of these issues, but I firmly believe that the majority of those charged with crimes in my county do have these factors in their lives. No matter how long I do this work, I still find myself regularly stunned by the ignorance of some of my clients, manifested by their foolish, often self-destructive decisions in their cases. As often as not, I'm appointed to represent someone who has a lifetime of bad decision-making. Then I try to get them to make rational decisions on how to handle their criminal case. It's a tough sell. On a purely intellectual level, I feel I have insight into the forces which brought them to this point in their lives. But the reality of dealing with this client base can be frustrating and at times infuriating. At least once a week, I have to suppress the urge to strangle one of my clients. My public defender clients fall roughly into the following groupings with considerable overlap. The real sociopaths. This is a truly mean group that mental health professionals would classify as antisocial personality disorder. They are fortunately a very small slice of my client base. As a general rule, they do not or cannot feel empathy for other people. They do not concern themselves with the physical fear or pain, the psychological terror, the economic hardship, the inconvenience, or the just plain damage that they do to others. This does not make them especially accomplished criminals, because at least those I represent are getting caught, and often with minimal effort by law enforcement. Much of their conduct is self-defeating. Usually the gain they realize or hope to realize for their criminal behavior is minimal. $50 armed robberies, $500 forged check scams, a sexual assault where they're easily identified. Included in this group are those filled with rage. I get a lot of anger that is targeted at almost anyone and that they see as an authority figure or who just seems to get in their path. The more angry and defiant they are, the more likely they are to be self-destructive in their behavior. I suspect a lot of self-loathing is behind this anger. Not surprisingly, this group includes some murderers I've defended in capital cases, but a minority of them. If I had to make a mental note of the meanest people I've represented over the years, few of them would be murderers. They would be the chronic, violent young men who live lives filled with conflict and almost a complete absence of meaningful personal relationships. A much larger group that is probably the biggest common denominator with my clients is substance abuse. A substantial portion of those charged with drug crimes are either addicts or are often small-time dealers supporting their own habits through their dealings, or they are mentally ill and damaged and are clearly self-medicating. Many people live lives of complete disaster. They are poor, they have no job skills, few interpersonal skills, and they have terrible diseases like AIDS and schizophrenia with little or no treatment. They are not part of intact families, and sometimes for reasons completely beyond their control, they're not part of intact families. They have been raped or abused as children. They're simply overwhelmed by the challenges of life. They drown in hopelessness and see nothing but despair in their futures. Drugs are an opiate that make the hours tolerable. Another part of this subset is the mentally ill, who for reasons we are still trying to understand are disabled by hallucinations, by extreme anxiety, by deep pits of depression or manic episodes. The beer and the crack dampen the voices in their head, quiet the jangled nerves, and bring sleep or stupor. Also, while handling a Florida death penalty case, I encountered a devastating condition called fetal alcohol syndrome, and the much less often diagnosed and therefore more sinister fetal alcohol affect. This is a devastating disorder of the brain and neurological system affecting behavior which can result from a mother's alcohol consumption during pregnancy. There is no cure. These children are disabled for the rest of their lives because of their mother's conduct. The mentally ill and mentally retarded. Only rarely are criminal defendants evaluated to determine the extent of mental illness or mental retardation. Defendants can be very ill in this area and still competent to stand trial. An insanity defense requires that their illness completely rob them of the ability to differentiate right from wrong. I would estimate that at least a quarter of my clients, perhaps half, would be diagnosed with a mental illness or mental retardation if evaluated. At any given time, the mentally retarded, by the way, constitute about 1% of live births in our population. have another category here that fits just about all of them. I call the inadequate. The great majority of my public defender clients could best be described as inadequate. They just do not have the skills to cope in our demanding society. They have poor interpersonal skills that lead them to misunderstand others, often to argue and fight when it's completely unnecessary. They are impulsive. They lash out in anger without thinking. Self-defeating outbursts in our courtrooms are not uncommon. They cannot analyze and understand the consequences of their conduct, thinking things through to points B, C, and D that will naturally follow from a rash leap to point A. It is not so much a matter of being hot-blooded, more dull and foolish. Maybe it's a matter of their just not learning from past conduct and consequences, which is a particular feature of mental retardation. They are easily led by vocal and more strongly willed acquaintances. Almost all, you know, I hesitate to use estimates sometimes, but it's hard for me to pick out, to count on my fingers the number of clients I have who grew up in intact families. I don't see that. Rarely do I see families of my clients that who grew up in anything even remotely resembling the church's proclamation on the family. The norm is being raised by a mother who is often a substance abuser and or gravitates to abusive and predatory men, grandmothers who are often well-motivated but overmatched, or defendants who've been shuffled around from one point in our dreadful foster care system to another. In their homes, they learn from arguing and violence, substance abuse, lack of planning and motivation in economic lives, as well as a variety of other ills that do not produce healthy children. They grow up in chaos. Some are runaways, growing up in the just as chaotic and predatory streets. They learn that they have no value as human beings, and that the world is an angry and violent place, and that in order to survive, they must act accordingly. As people, they are the people that society has thrown away. Trouble with the law often runs in families. A study of the U.S. Justice Department found that about half of the nation's inmates are parents of children under 18. The study also found that almost 1.5 million children had a parent in prison, an increase of more than 500,000 children since 1991. I rarely ask my clients if they have relatives with criminal histories, but if the subject comes up, the answer is almost always yes. It wasn't until I represented a Florida death row inmate who grew up in an alcoholic and who grew up as an alcoholic and heroin addict that I fully appreciated how destructive battling parents can be to a child. My client was never beaten. He was mostly ignored while his parents drank, screamed, and threw things at each other nearly every day. He grew up to become a fragile adult with no sense of self-worth, who could not deal with any kind of stress in his life and had to stay intoxicated to survive. He was so intoxicated at the time of his murder that he could not recall any of it. Women represent a very small portion of my caseload, less than 1 in 20, maybe less than 1 in 30. However, I've observed that there are some significant differences between my female clients and my male clients. Some of the most pathetic, broken human beings I've ever encountered have been female clients with histories of abusive relationships resulting in violent injury, severe substance abuse problems, and no intact families to turn to. I've heard forensic social workers remark that boys act out and girls act up. That's why boys fight and girls get pregnant. They tend to turn the anger against themselves, whereas the men are more likely to lash out at the world. My women clients seem more likely to be substance abusers and mentally ill. When I have our office social worker prepare a social history, I get a great deal of sexual molestation and violent abuse reported back to me. The crack and the beer are obvious self-medication. My own reading is that there's a lot of self-loathing amongst these women. I personally believe that girls who grow up fatherless have a much harder time learning healthy relationships with men in their adult lives. I'll maybe come back to this during Q&A, but right now I'm representing a 19-year-old girl in a triple homicide in Austin, where the state is seeking to execute her. The murders took place when she was 18, and she has one of the most horrendous histories of abuse and predation that I've ever encountered. I'm hopeful that I'm going to be able to persuade the district attorney to not seek death on her when I can present all that to them. At this point, I want to talk a little bit about, if I have the time, how do people get this way? After years in this law practice, I began to wonder, how does an apparently normal baby grow into adulthood with so much anger and potential violence in them? You get this pretty pink child, this infant, this gift from God. How do they get to what I see as 17, 18-year-old kids? I mean, that mystified me at first, but I've come to understand that there is a formula for it. You can make any child into a monster with relatively little effort. Forensic psychologist James Garbano explains in his book, Lost Boys, and this is a book I strongly recommend to anyone who's interested in this area, how children who grow up in lives of abuse, violence, and rejection often become the angry and violent adult criminal defense lawyers like myself are called upon to represent. Early in his book, he observes, psychiatrist Leonard Schengold called his book on the effects of severe child abuse, Soul Murder. He chose this title to reflect his belief that the catastrophically abused child, subject to so much internal devastation, is driven beyond the limits of humanness. I'm not in a position to debate the theological issue of whether or not souls can die or be killed, but I do believe that Scheingold's views contain an important insight. At a very least, souls can be wounded. At the extreme of human devastation and degradation, it may well be true that the human psyche can be so terribly mutilated that the soul departs, leaving behind something else to fill the void, or perhaps just leaving an unfilled void. From what I've seen, the more likely course of development is that when forced to live in hell, the soul withdraws, perhaps shutting itself off from the world outside in a desperate attempt at preservation. Once hidden away, it covers itself with layers of insulation. As the years pass, this protective shell may harden to the point where eventually the soul seems dormant, so out of touch with the day-to-day self that it has become even a tormented person. There are such individuals in our midst, and most of them end up in prisons and mental institutions. Parental abandonment by a significant adult in a child's life is a huge issue with some individuals. Most of us gain esteem when we grow up valued by someone important to us. Parental abandonment is destruction of self-esteem, teaching a child that he has been abandoned because he is not worthy of parental presence. Studies have found that although cultures differ in how they express rejection, rejected children everywhere are at heightened risk for a host of psychological problems ranging from low self-esteem to truncated moral development to difficulty handling aggression and sexuality. A child who has not experienced the love of a parent or a parent figure surely has a more difficult time experiencing and appreciating God's love. Such abandonment is not only physical, but social if a parent simply withdraws or becomes emotionally unavailable. Mental illness, substance abuse, family violence, and the pressures of extreme poverty can all effectively remove a physically present parent from a child's life. Absent fathers are a well-known topic, but absent mothers are surprisingly common as well. Boys who are abandoned by their fathers and are not fortunate enough to have another effective adult male in their lives lose an important social teacher in how to instruct them on how to handle aggression and how to manage male energy. A present but abusive father can be even more problematic. The presence of an abusive father teaches sons some very dangerous lessons about being a man, often lessons that are unconsciously learned. As Latter-day Saints, we believe in a gospel of eternal progression. Our spiritual movement, an eternal life where our spiritual state is not static. We have lived, we live now, and we will live after death. And there is a spiritual dimension to each of those states. We learn, we grow, we apply what we have learned, and we move to another level. And we can backslide. We progress one way or another. We are never stationary. We do not progress in a vacuum. Every spirit is individual, with an individual past, an individual future, and an individual character. Our past contains individual decisions, and our present is very much determined by those decisions. This is not predestination or predetermination, but influences. We are always free agents. God gave us the ability to make choices. Thou mayest choose for thyself. He cannot and will not take the power of choices away from us. I do not believe in a God who is angry, petty, vengeful, rigid, or even crabby. My faith is in a God who is much better than I. He loves me. He understands my weakness. He is pulling for me to succeed. He coaches me when I listen. He is both loving and fair. He is at least as good and kind as my own earthly father, which I was very much blessed to have. I firmly believe that we are each judged by what we know, by the opportunities we are given in this life, and what we did with those blessings. If we were not blessed with certain advantages, we cannot be punished for not taking advantage of those advantages. This essay should not be read as an argument that dangerous individuals like Dr. Garbarino's lost boys should be set free among us. Society has a right to protect itself from dangerous people, even if they are dangerous as a result of damage completely beyond their control. While I clearly believe that man's judgment is deeply flawed, I firmly believe that God's judgment is more perfect than man's. It is my personal opinion that we will judge ourselves when we pass through the veil. I suspect the resurrection and last judgment will be a time when our minds and spirits will be cleared, when we must confront the choices we made in this mortal existence and consider them against the advantages we had in the temporal sphere. My gospel principles lesson manual includes the following thought. President John Taylor taught this truth: the individual tells the story himself and bears witness himself. That record that is written by the man himself in the tables of his own mind, the record that cannot lie, will in that day be unfolded before God and the angels and those who sit as judges. God has given me a great deal, me personally, a good family, a good mind, all the educational advantages one could have, the ability to serve and make good gospel-directed decisions. I'm not poor, I'm not stupid, I'm not hungry, I've never been abused, I've never suffered racism, I've never wanted for anything. D&C 82:3 includes, "For him unto whom much is given, much is required." I anticipate I will judge my own conduct harshly in this context. One conclusion I've reached is that I'm not prepared to judge others. The human condition, what blessings and burdens we carry in this mortal sphere, are far too complex for my puny mind to sort through. I have enough trouble evaluating the good and bad in my own life. I do have the prejudiced opinion that people who find it easy to pass judgment on their fellows are absolutely the wrong spirits to do it. Mostly, I hope and believe that God the Father is a better person than I. Thank you.
As an attorney with 23 years of experience practicing and a large number of criminal cases during that period of time, I've had a chance to see at a grassroots level some of the things that Ken has mentioned here in his paper. I've never had a capital case, but I have done a number of are called here in Utah first-degree felony defenses, and find that the description of the environmental triggers that influence the type of behavior that leads to this type of criminal conduct is a subject that really is of interest and bears a lot of study and review. I appreciate Ken's description of these environmental triggers and his observations that he has shared, and would suggest that as these case studies are developed, that there be some further research, some empirical research, to determine some of the relationships that are involved there. I know in his article he refers to several treatises and other books and articles on this particular topic, which ought to be of some interest. But I agree with his general proposition that not all are accountable for the same things and to the same extent. The question comes up as to the relationship between environmental factors, how much are environmental factors, and how much baggage we bring to this life. And I think in Ken's treatise, if I understand his proposition correctly, he is suggesting that all of us enter this life as innocents, and all of us begin with a clean table or slate, and that therefore the choices that begin being made are in fact mostly environmental. And it would be interesting to study. One of the things that I've been involved with to a large extent is adoptions. It would be interesting to take people from predictably criminal environments, place them in an adoptive setting, and do a retrospective study on how many of them actually succumb to the same difficulties that their peers from similar environmental that are subject to similar environmental factors come from. I think that would be an interesting follow-up type study. So the question comes up, how much of this is environmental? We know that environmental factors are tremendously important, but it does bring to mind a number of different questions. Dr. Duane Jeffries, scientist and geneticist at BYU, has done some work with regard to criminology and has pointed out that there is a disproportionate number of criminals who have a chromosomal defect, either a trisomic XXY, triple XY, in some cases quadruple XY chromosome structure that leads to susceptibility to criminal type behavior. So it would be interesting to see whether or not this personal genetic structure is actually of influence, and what percentage of the criminal population has this particular type of anomaly, and whether you would count that as a personal or an environmental trigger. Another question that is brought up, in a lot of recent literature, including literature of near-death experiences and a large number of psychological reports done by Michael Newton, Brian Weiss, and others, we find mention made of people selecting the environment and the circumstances that they will be born into before they come to this world. And having the ability to recall that in psychological counseling and testing in various degrees, or as part of a near-death experience. For example, Betty Eady, in her book Embraced by the Light, describes that during a near-death experience, she had the opportunity of viewing a community situation in which she saw a drunk man, on a street and she was able to see beyond his present circumstance to see that he was a person of extreme incredible eternal talent and usefulness, who, as she put it, she was given to understand, had agreed to enter this life in a capacity of one with diminished opportunities and dissipated possibilities to provide learning experiences for others, much as we Latter-day Saints feel about the spirit, for example, of a Down syndrome child, or somebody who is born into this life with special challenges, not just to get through this life on their own behalf, but to provide an opportunity for those around them to grow and develop and learn. And so as we read about some of these type of experiences, one has to question whether or not the experiences or the circumstances that we subject ourselves to in this life may go beyond the mere response to environmental triggers and have a higher meaning. Another question is raised with regard to the fairness of life. Since life is a very short period of time, is it really fair? And can it be fair to judge a person placed in limited circumstances for the type of conduct that develops? And I think Ken attempted to address this problem by saying, you have to judge people differently. You have to take into account the circumstances that have taken place in their lives. But to take that idea one step further, it's possibly amazing to think that in an LDS, from an LDS context, that we spend an unlimited amount of time as a pre-existent spirit to be thrust into a limited circumstance of 70 or 80 years, plus or minus, to have an entire eternity based on that period, and then to spend an undetermined amount of time thereafter with this as the one experience that is available for learning, available for being subjected to a mortal existence. And so one has to question the fairness and the opportunity and the ability to deal with that, and it raises a lot of different questions. Can we judge or can we say about a person that is guilty of criminal conduct in this life, even though we are forced to deal with that in the now, in the present, can we ever say that we know that person, or that we know where they come from, or that this little snapshot of their life or this little bundle of conduct is who they are as an eternal being? I don't think so. In conclusion, let me just offer some congratulations to Ken for bringing up this topic and for allowing us to think about some of these issues and some of these questions. Appreciated the opportunity to review his article, and hope that we'll have a chance, maybe even right now through question and answer, to flesh out some of the questions that this article leaves for us to ponder. Thanks.
Okay, anyone who has questions, it'd be great if you would come up here and speak into the microphone so we don't have to be repetitive. Go ahead. Come on. come on up. And if you could say your name.
I'm Leanna Ray Scott. I just had a few comments and then a question. Bill, the thought came to me when you were talking about adoption studies, and in my experience, so many adopted children have trauma from that experience. I don't know if that would be a very effective way to study what you were talking about, because that introduces extra trauma to children. At least that's been my experience. I really appreciate about in Canada was that so many of our people sitting in jails are fetal alcohol syndrome and fetal alcohol effect children. And it's heartening to see that finally we're getting some of this and that we're trying to make a difference. We're trying to have a different response to abused women and treat it for what it really is and treat the problems. My question is, do you see in your career, have you seen a change in how society is reacting? I mean, it sounds to me like you are preparing information for the courts to help them to see things. One time I read about one community, I believe in the U.S., who saw that most of these young men who were ending up in jails had a dearth of life skills, and so they, rather than just warehouse them, they had life skills classes to teach these people these skills. Do you see any difference in societal reaction coming from our increased knowledge about what the factors are? Thank you.
Well, I'll address two of those points. One on adoptions. This is purely anecdotal. I don't know if anybody that's done any studies of it, but in capital cases, I think a disproportionate portion of capital defendants are adopted. A couple of years ago, we noticed in Georgia a real rash of capital defendants who were Asian adoptions. Asian babies who were adopted and brought over here, usually as infants. There didn't appear to be anything in their histories that would suggest what was happening, but at one point we were running about 20% of the pending capital cases in Georgia were adopted children. So I'm sure there is a factor there. I don't know of anybody who's ever actually studied it. In terms of societal reactions, it's been my reaction that we are moving in the other direction. The move in this country for some time has been towards minimum mandatory sentencing that doesn't recognize these factors. A great many judges I practice in front of don't care why these guys act out. They want them off the streets and locked up. Their view is that society should be protected from them. In capital work, there is something called the Capital Jury Project. It's an effort that the data is housed in some little liberal arts college in Ohio. I forget the name of the school. But the theory is whenever a jury imposes a death sentence in the United States, they attempted to have detailed non-judgmental, with the examiners, the questioners don't disclose anything about their attitudes, interviews with at least three members of each of that jury to find out how they are making those decisions. And one of the things that they have found is that a great many jurors in capital cases in the United States regard mental illness and these other things as an indication that this individual is so damaged we should kill them. That they are not, that they don't see it as mitigating, they see it as aggravating. So that's forcing capital lawyers to kind of reevaluate whether you even want to present a jury with that information. But it's my feeling that with budget pressures and sort of public fear of crime, the trend is very much in the other direction. It is in the direction of lengthier sentences and whatever treatment programs and life skills programs that were in prisons are falling victim to budget pressures. I think we're going in the wrong direction.
Just real briefly, in Utah, there is a threshold that takes place even before the trial. If there's a mental illness defense that's undertaken, there is an opportunity to move the case out of the criminal system into the mental health forum. And that's used quite frequently. What's usually done is the person, if there's a serious crime committed, the person is put in a special location in a mental health facility and evaluated and given an opportunity to undergo treatment so that their if their mental health prevents them from participating adequately in their defense, or that they do suffer from a diminished capacity, that can be addressed almost from the beginning now in the mental health setting. Society is still protected because they're off the streets, but nevertheless the treatment of those individuals is quite different in that setting than it would be in the ordinary criminal system. And that, in this particular state, that's kind of becoming a well-developed way of dealing with the mentally and environmentally disadvantaged people that are suffering in that way.
I got a couple of questions, and I guess they're kind of for the audience as much as for the panel members, because I don't think any one person can answer them. The first question is, assuming that we do know what the causes are of crime and the problems that have been discussed here, does that mean that we have an obligation as a society to do everything we can to try to mitigate these circumstances and try to end the deprivation? Or do we make the assumption that God has set these circumstances up for his own purposes and we should let nature take its course? And the second question is, assuming the first answer, if we determine that the problem really is genetic or nature rather than nurture, then what would be appropriate steps to take in those situations? Are we talking about genetic manipulation? Are we talking about selective breeding? How would we deal with a situation like that?
I'm not sure I have any simple answers for the questions that I've posited. I would say, yes, to the kind of first part of that question, my own view of the gospel and Mormonism is that we each, as members of the church, have an affirmative obligation to make the world a better place. We have an obligation to make the lives of the people around us better. And that means we go out and we do good. You know, we do something good each day or look for an opportunity to do that. And I think that admonition falls into this area too. I think we all have the chance to touch lives. I don't think that we are anyone in this room is going to solve all of society's problems. But you may find some kid who you can make a difference for. And so in that sense, I mean, that sounds kind of Pollyanna, but I do believe that. And as to the sort of larger picture, it's awfully expensive to hold somebody in prison for a year. I personally think we ought to be investing more of our public resources, and I think it's cheaper to invest it on the front end of the process and try to catch these kids. You know, if we even catch 10, 15, 20% of them and divert them or even just lessen the severity of their crimes, it's going to cost us less money. I just think we, as a society, we've had a tendency to invest our efforts at the wrong end of the process when it becomes a crisis and we have to deal with it because this kid just stuck up a liquor store. We ought to be working with this kid when he's a youngster and trying to help keep his family together. This kind of work has made me much more conservative and about traditional families, because I don't think there's any place that's going to teach these lessons any more than an intact working family. We need to be working to try to support those structures there.
We have time for maybe two more questions if we can keep them short.
I'll try and be real, real short on this, but I'm impressed by the tremendous difference in individuals and their capabilities. And I've postulated the suggestion that we had tremendous opportunity in the pre-mortal existence to learn and serve and teach. And you think of Peter, James, and John being apostles of Christ before Adam and Eve were on the earth. And you go from that point of view to the point of view of thinking that probably is not doctrine. But I would suggest that we actually knew a great deal about the social situation, about our genome patterns, about the cultural circumstances, and that we volunteered to come at a certain time in a certain place in order so that we had choices in this rather than being here just to get a body and be tested by a mean, ugly God who wants to test us. That is not real doctrine, but there's many references that will make you think that we prepared ourselves and we chose to come at the time and the place and with the patterns that we were going to be existed. Does that make any sense to you all?
I don't know that there, it's really something I can respond to. I would tell you that as a criminal defense lawyer, I'm confronted with dealing with the problems my clients have here and now. I have to fix the problems that I can deal with. I can't do anything about what was going on the other side of the veil, but I see problems here and now, and that's what I've got to try to address and understand where that comes from in my clients.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry, I saw him first. I apologize.
I'll stick around afterwards.
But that's fine, go ahead.
Have you speculated that the biblical explanation of evil, like people being possessed by evil spirits, and God talking about punishment being to the third and fourth generation, that being a natural consequence, maybe those are just biblical coping strategies to explain the kind of individuals you defend? I don't know, have you thought about it?
I actually have thought about that, and I don't know that they're necessarily inconclusive. Frankly, a lot of what psychiatrists would classify as antisocial personality disorder certainly would meet the biblical definition of evil. I just think that we're still trying to understand some of where it comes from, and if we can affect it, maybe we'll determine that we can affect these kinds of abnormalities in the human condition. I don't discount the idea of possession and evil, but I do think that we need to be careful that we're not leaping there and trying as an excuse to not understand what's going on and to not deal with things that we can deal with here on this earth. And I think the great majority of things are things that we can deal with on this earth.
Well, that occurred to me as I was listening to you is the question that you actually raised: what kinds of political and social obligation arise for us as a result of an encounter of this kind of information and your kind of experience. And I just want to give a juxtaposed experience for a minute. Two or three years ago, I spent a year in East Germany, or former East Germany, and had some long conversations with a psychiatrist there who was a psychiatrist under the communist regime for many years. He is now a very successful psychiatrist in what has become a capitalist, a free, democratic society. What she told me is that her practice has increased dramatically, that she sees a great many more troubled children than she saw in the past. In the past, in the society in which they lived, various institutions were expected to act in loco parentis. That is, when parents failed, and parents sometimes do fail their children, then there were backup organizations. There would be the daycare systems, because there were extensive daycare systems. Mothers worked. Everybody worked in that system. So there was an extensive and responsible daycare system. Schools were expected to act in loco parentis, to worry about the raising and be concerned about the welfare of children. There were required organizations for youth, called pioneers in particular, that acted responsibly to take care of children who are not being taken care of by parents who should take care of them. She said all of those things were in place, so there were many backup systems, and it was a community taking care of its children. Her caseload was very different. Now, in a democratic society, daycare has virtually disappeared. That's not there. Families are to be rely on themselves, and many do. Schools refuse to take over parental responsibilities because that's not their job. Their job is to educate. And youth organizations have virtually disappeared. She sees many, many dysfunctional children who come to her for psychiatric care because these other backup systems have disappeared. It seems to me we live in a world, and you say we need rely on traditional families, where backup systems have disappeared. I think most of us, like me, don't think about people in prison. They're a long way away. We built very large prisons and invested a lot of money. We spend more on that in Ohio, where I live, than we do on higher education presently. I really wonder what kind, and this is religious people of social obligation and concern and political obligation we face when we encounter this kind of information, this kind of dysfunction in the society around us.
Yeah, I'll just make one very brief comment. Actually, I'm aware of several studies that show that there's a direct substantial correlation between prison visits by families and recidivism. Inmates who are not visited by families reoffend. Inmates who are visited by families and continue to have a relationship like that are much less likely to reoffend. If we want to look at a practical starting point, make it possible for families to visit their members in prison.
Thank you, everyone.